For the week of November 1st, 2015, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 300, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, just back from the Apple Hospital, I'm Michael Giltz.
I'm assuming you don't mean Apple as in fruit, but Apple as in a computer.
That's right. I've been bedeviled by problems for 2 weeks. I've lived at the Apple Store at Fifth Avenue and in Grand Central. Finally got my computer back minutes ago, just in time for the exciting 300th episode.
Now, you're assuming, audience, that Michael is saying that he was living at the Apple Store because of his computer, but actually that's just because he's homeless.
That's right. And it's more comfortable than the refrigerator box that I slept in on under the bridge.
Well, and I guess, you know, you also could have been referring to that Apple that pops up out of the little top hat there at Citibank Field, where
that's right. Unfortunately, the Mets lost, but they played a good series. They had a good team. And you know what? 30 years ago, Kansas City won. And then the following year, the Mets won the World Series. So maybe that'll happen again.
Ooh, that would actually be very, very interesting, don't you think?
Absolutely. The Mets will very likely be, you know, they'll certainly be competitive next year. They got a great young team, a lot of good pitching. So they'll be in the mix and hopefully they can come back again. Of course, I root for the Yankees first and foremost. I want them to crush the Mets in the World Series. But if we don't make it, I like them to do well. But, you know, hey, I could have been outside. I could have been at the Apple Store because of my computer. I could have been under that bridge in the box, or I could have just been online, right? Did you get your ticket, Sperling?
You know what? No, not yet. I haven't, actually. But let me ask you, did you get your tickets? I mean,
well, I didn't, but my sister did in London. She got two tickets for February of 2017, and my friend Luis got tickets for January of 2017 because everything else before that was sold out.
Well, I mean, it makes sense because, look, wait, 2017? I got confused as to what year we're in. 2017, that's like a year, that's over a year away. So how
that's
is it that
right.
You couldn't get Star Wars tickets until 2017? That's not what I'm going to be showing in 2017.
Star Wars, please. I'm talking about Harry Potter. Harry Potter is coming to the West End in two parts, starting in May of 2016. They released 4 months of tickets and they disappeared.
Yep. So it's not a musical, it's a play, right?
It is a play. It's right. In two parts. You got to go two evenings or like matinee and evening. They haven't even finished writing it. They haven't even finished casting it. They don't have sets. It's going to start in May of 2016. And they put May to September up, gone. September to January of 2017, gone. Now they put another set. I mean, they're sold out for like a year, literally sold out.
I don't think that's ever happened before, has it?
Well, certainly there's been high demands for shows. Absolutely. Shows open to $20 or $30 million advances. Absolutely. But a two-part play, you know, announced tickets on sale 6 months in advance. It's pretty crazy. But I guess, like you say, people are lined up for Star Wars tickets. People are lined up for tickets to Harry Potter, which proves the importance of
franchises. Pepsi jinx.
That's right. Yeah, so Star Wars is coming out. They released a bunch of tickets, and all we know is that they sold a lot. We don't know how many. There's 10 times the last amount that was sold when we did a one-day in advance sale. But, like, the number of tickets? No idea.
So we're talking about Star Wars now, right?
That's right.
Yeah, okay. So, you know, with IMAX, I think they're up to $10 million in advance sales, the largest gross ever in advance
sales. Why
would
you go to see it in IMAX? Terrible idea.
I'm just repeating what the news is. But yeah, I mean, it broke Fandango. Fandango being a North American web ticketing company. They had a first day sales record.
Right. But they won't tell us what it is. That's my complaint. Oh, we sold a lot. Well, if you want, everybody wrote tons of stories. Eight times the heaviest traffic of... How many tickets did they sell? Tell us how many tickets you sold. Otherwise, shut up.
You know, I love that. It's like the amount of Star Wars news this week was remarkable. I mean, you had all of this stuff of breaking the ticketing, you know, web ticketing.
Oh, please.
But then
websites crashed briefly. It happens all the time.
But what? Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. When was the last time Emperor Palpatine won a true and real election?
Well, I believe if you look at Star Wars novel 47, that the last time he won an unrigged election was in the year, I don't know.
Okay, well, what I'm talking about is Emperor Palpatine, specifically Palpatine Dimitri. He was a 25-year-old man who, I guess, he ran for, city council in Odessa, in the Ukraine, Odessa City Council, and he won. And actually, the Ukrainian Internet Party had a number of Star Wars characters on the ballot, including Darth Vader, Yoda,
People change their names to these characters just to run for office?
I don't know. I guess if you're
all a member of the... Why are we talking about this? And where did you read about this? The Hollywood Reporter.
Yes.
Which won awards for its online coverage, and they do some great in-depth stories and some really good features about Hollywood figures and land, and I mean, some very substantial good reporting, but this is the kind of nonsense I could do without.
Well, come on, Chewbacca being arrested
for
outside a polling station for wearing the costume.
The show. What are we going to...
What about the
nonsense?
Lenin statue? It's Darth Vader. They turned a statue of Lenin into Darth Vader because they had to get rid of communist symbols in the Ukraine, so they literally transformed it into... No? You don't like that?
So tell our people what we're going to talk about on this week's episode.
Okay, fine. On this week's show, well, I guess we'll find out who won the Chinese lottery. And by that, actually, we mean which Hollywood or imported movie were given 2015 release dates under the country's restrictive quota system. Remember, they only let 34 imported films into the country each year. So we're going to find out which ones will play out through 2015 and which will have to wait until next year. We'll also get into what has come to be known as Gamergate, a movement that began in August of last year and is focused on sexism and progressivism in video game culture.
Or the lack thereof.
Yes. South by Southwest caused quite a stir last week when they canceled two panels at their 2016 conference in Austin over threats of violence from Gamergaters, as they have come to be known. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week, except apparently anything having to do with Star Wars. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office and nothing having to do with Star Wars.
That's right. And we're talking about the box office around the world. We get our information from RentTrak and pull info as well from The Hollywood Reporter, Variety, The LA Times, The New York Times, you name it. And the number one movie around the world is James Bond, Spectre, $80 million around the world, which just happens to be the amount of money it's expected to make when it opens in New York, in America this weekend. But $80 million, a record amount in the UK. It's off to a flying start. People wondered, will it make as much as the last Bond film, the first one to cross $1 billion worldwide? Well, it's certainly on its way.
Well, and to give you some sense and put this in perspective, $80 million in the UK alone over one weekend?
No, it wasn't in the UK. Wasn't it $63 million in the UK?
Oh.
It's six territories.
Okay, so yeah, whatever it made in the UK, it was a phenomenal amount, and I will look it up while we move on, but it was like, you know, I think like $5-10 million in the UK on an opening weekend. People are very, very happy just in the UK alone, you know, to make like $50-60 million. And of course, we understand, for those of you in the UK, that you do
it's
not
their
pay...
baby. It's their baby.
Well, we also know that you don't pay for your movie tickets in dollars. You pay for them in pounds.
Whoa. So... Well, we've converted. What are you talking about?
I know we're converting, but okay. I'm just, you know, giving
why did you mention that?
I don't know.
Okay. And number two around the world is Adam Sandler's Hotel Transylvania 2. Another $40 million. It's at $373 million and counting. Clearly, it's going to blow past $400 million, maybe $450 before all is said and done. And number three is Matt Damon's The Martian, a movie I saw and found wildly disappointing.
Really?
Yes, absolutely. It's not as good as Gravity, which wasn't nearly as good as Apollo 13. It was fine. I like Matt Damon. It was painless, but there was a lot of dumb stuff and a very weak ending. But anyway, it's made $28 million because everyone else loves it. $428 million worldwide, but I'm telling you now, this will not be an Oscar contender except for, you know, technical categories. At number four around the world is Vin Diesel in The Last Witch Hunter. $23 million for the weekend, $60 million worldwide and counting. Decent launch for what might be a franchise? I don't know. We'll have to see. And number five is a Chinese film. It's The Witness. This is a remake of a Korean crime drama called Blind, and it was off to a good start. $18 million on its opening weekend. Jack Black is having fun. Goosebumps, another $17 million. It's at $75 million worldwide and counting.
What do you mean he's having fun? His HBO series, The Brink, was just canceled.
Well, at least he's got a potential movie franchise.
That's true.
Got to take a sting out of it. Mind you, on the other hand, if one person went to see the movie for every copy of the book that they've sold, which is like a billion and counting, it would be worth a lot more money. And number seven is Paranormal Activity, the fifth film in this franchise. It made $17 million over the weekend. It's at $51 million worldwide. Sperling.
Oh, I know you were going to ask me this, and I totally didn't look it up, and I should have.
What do you mean? I got all the info down. I got all the info down below there. I'm just saying, what do you think about the Paranormal Activity movie? This was the one that they wanted to do the early window, lot of theaters wouldn't show it because they said, look, we're going to rush it out onto video on demand because it's a horror film and it's after Halloween and nobody's going to care about it in a few weeks. So we might as well make as much money as possible. We'll give you a cut. Just let us shorten the window because of this unique situation. We'll see how it works out. So they did. And of course, it didn't do great at the box office compared to the last few. But where is it all ending up overall? What do you think of it? Is this like the death knell for trying to shorten the window, or what's going on?
No, I don't think so at all. I think this is what they're up to $51 million worldwide now, right?
And yes.
It's been out for what, 3 weeks?
Yes.
And
of course, it's after Halloween.
It's after Halloween.
It will fall off the cliff, presumably.
And, you know, I think most people had no idea about this window thing. I don't think...
Well, audiences didn't stay away, but like maybe because some theater chains wouldn't show it, it would have made more money in the theater, that sort of thing. Did they put the kibosh on this experiment, or is this a bad example, but they can try again, or what's going on?
Well, to give you some sense, we're 3 weeks in, it's made $13 million in the United States, or let's call it $13.5 million in the United States. The last Paranormal Activity film, The Marked Ones, made a total of $32.4 million, and it's probably not going to hit that number. It's
no,
probably
of course
not.
But you know, you look at all five movies, and you've got, this is the sixth movie in the franchise.
Yes.
So the first three made about $200 million worldwide, which is crazy because it's basically a movie about, oh, honey, I left the DVR on. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, I left my iPhone on, honey. Oh, my God, there's a ghost. You know, that's the entire premise, and they've done it six times.
There's still a ghost. There's a ghost again.
The first three movies made $200 million. Eventually, you hit a wall. The fourth movie made $140 million worldwide. The fifth movie made $86 million worldwide.
No, so made $90 million worldwide, $90.9 million worldwide.
All right, I'm sorry. I had $86 million according to the source I had. So $90 million, but that's still roughly the same amount. So $200 million to $140 million to $90 million worldwide. If you know nothing about anything, you don't even know what the movie franchise is, if you look at those five movies in a row and say, we're making another one, what do you think it's going to make?
Less.
200 to 140 to 90. You're thinking, plus each one is going to start to accelerate the decline. You're like, maybe 50 million, right?
No, by 50%, no, you probably say it'll make 75%, which is actually what it's going to do.
Well, it may if you're really lucky, but you know, it dropped 40% the last one, then another, it dropped 30%, then 40%, then, you know, it accelerates. People get tired of them. They don't all keep dropping the same amount. The fact is, if you didn't know anything about them, a blind anonymous test, here's these movies, what's the next one going to make? Of course it's going to make less, probably significantly less. You've made five movies already. It's the sixth one with the same story. So of course it's going to make less. So this Paranormal Activity does not mean anything about the windows or anything like that. Did it underperform in the U.S., in North America? Could it have made more if more theater chains had shown it? Maybe, maybe, maybe. We'll never know. But the fact is, for the franchise overall, it's certainly not being hurt in any noticeable way because they've drained that puppy dry.
Yeah. I mean, to give you some sense, the fifth film in the franchise opened to $18 million, right? Mm-hmm. Now, when you look at that, you look at, okay, it's only made the sixth film has only made $13.5 million in the U.S. to date. So you're seeing, obviously, the number of theaters it's in is affecting the opening. But my question would be, did it?
Yeah. I mean, it's erosion. Of course it's going to get eroded. And number eight is another Oscar hopeful. It's Bridge of Spies, the Steven Spielberg film starring Tom Hanks. $11 million over the weekend, $57 million and counting. It's trudging along as adults come to the movie and discover it. I did it last weekend. And again, I was disappointed. At number nine around the world is Ant-Man, another $11 million, $513 million worldwide for the Paul Rudd franchise. Yes, we can call it a franchise. At number 10 is Crimson Peak, Guillermo del Toro's movie. He's proving an increasing disappointment. $8 million over the weekend, $61 million worldwide. This isn't going to end up pretty, but we'll wait till all the numbers are added up. And at number 11, a success, The Intern. $8 million over the weekend, $150 million worldwide for a movie that I think cost, was it $30 million, $40 million? I forget what The Intern cost because it's been a few weeks, and I didn't have my computer, so I couldn't write everything in.
Actually, I just pulled it up here, and it looks like it cost $35 million, an estimated $35 million.
Right. Of course, you got De Niro involved and Nancy Myers, so, you know, put an asterisk by that. But nonetheless, certainly a solid success story.
Right.
But in North America, stars don't always guarantee success. People are scratching their heads. Why did Bradley Cooper's new movie not do well? Why did Sandra Bullock's movie not do well? Because they looked bad. Burnt was a flop on opening weekend, as was, what's it called? Our Brand is Crisis. And you know what? Our Brand is Crisis. Actually, it's not. Sandra Bullock is not in crisis mode just because she made a movie that didn't click. But both have other movies that do better. That's what stars do. They appear in a lot of movies. They usually pull people in on opening weekend. That's their job, but they're not magic, right?
That's correct. I mean, I think if you look at the definition of a star, or historically how stars kind of wax and wane, where they're kind of on top.
Like the moon.
Just like the moon. You know, sometimes they're red hot and then they kind of taper off a little bit and then they come back. The fact that they can be a star is defined by their ability to come back and to redefine their career.
That's true. And, you know, I want a pat on the back.
Okay, I do that, but virtually that, I don't know if you'd feel it.
You're in LA and I'm here. That's right. Straight Out of Compton passed the $200 million mark worldwide. Good for them. They've only made $40 million overseas, and apparently they've opened up almost everywhere they're going to. I think this is not a case of the movie underperforming overseas, but just not being shown. Because if they're already at everywhere they're going, they hadn't played many territories. So I think a lot of countries just didn't take it, which is a mistake. They left money on the table, as far as I'm concerned. But it was a hit in the UK. It did well in the territories where it played, at least some of them. And, you know, $200 million worldwide. Good for them. But what did I say when it came out? I said, they're going to make a Sugar Hill Gang movie, right?
Oh, yeah. Yes, that's right. And sure enough, they are. I see what
they
you
are. Of course they are. Yeah. She's the mother of hip hop, the Sylvia Robinson, who helped co-found Sugar Hill Records. It's a great story, uprising from the ashes, a huge success, a little scrappy label, has the first top 40 hit for a hip hop song, and then it all comes crashing down, but it'll be fun.
Well, and we started off by talking about Spectre. Actually, yes. We started off by talking about Star Wars, a film title I have not mentioned in about 5 minutes, so I want to just throw it in there.
Contractually obliged.
Oh, yes. So Spectre made $63.8 million in its first 7 days of release in the UK, which surpasses the previous record held by Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. So not even the final.
The Prisoner of Azkaban?
Yes. So that should tell you how hard it is to make that much money in the UK in 7 days.
Not the final Harry Potter?
Exactly. That's what I'm saying.
Prisoner of Azkaban. Wow, that's interesting. Well, one thing we know is Spectre will be opening in China before the end of the year.
Are you sure about that? Can we just double check that? Because I know China has this, I don't want to call it a lottery, because it's not a lottery, but it kind of feels like a lottery, because it's like, okay, which of the films, these big blockbuster films, will actually get a slot from the China Film Group, which distributes all these movies?
And well, the answer is not Star Wars.
Yes, that's correct. Not Star Wars, which will downplay its global opening. Or not downplay, but reduce its global opening.
Right. But, you know, of course, that doesn't matter when all is said and done, you know. Unless you think that so many, you know, bootleg copies are going to come out that people won't turn out in the theater. But, you know, it doesn't matter whether you make your money in December or January. What matters is how much the movie costs and how much it ultimately makes at the theater. And then, of course, on DVD and Blu-ray and video on demand. But I'm sure they would have loved a big worldwide number. So if you're looking to set a record, it doesn't help to not be in the number two market day and date. And that won't happen for Star Wars. China announced the movies that are going to be scheduled for the end of the year. Star Wars is out. Picks Disney's The Good Dinosaur. It's two of their movies, also not getting a slot for the end of the year. So they had a bad moment here, you know? They don't have any more movies, I don't think, scheduled for the end of the year.
Well, and, you know, you say it doesn't matter, but for piracy concerns, it most certainly does. So,
which I mentioned, yeah.
Oh, you did? Okay. Well, then, yes, then you mentioned it. But, you know, ultimately, this is what China wanted. They wanted these big blockbusters to put into their theaters that they're building at a rapid pace. I mean, there's like, I think, what, 5 new screens per day being built in China right now?
But without the movies overwhelming their own product, which is proving increasingly successful.
Right. And it's also proving increasingly difficult to keep Hollywood movies at bay, even in their own country.
That's right. Fox had a good week when this announcements came out. They have The Maze Runner 2 coming out November 4th. They have the Peanuts movie, which has gotten good reviews from the trades that say, oh, it's sweet and it is in the spirit of the Peanuts and people may like it, even though it's in 3D and feels weird. But I don't know, maybe Peanuts has a big following in China. I don't know why they chose that, but that's a family film. And they also have The Martian, which, of course, has been a massive worldwide hit. That, too, will come out in China before the end of the year.
I don't think peanuts has a big following in China. I think it's...
How do you know?
I think it's cashews, actually.
Oh, God. Oh, God. I walked right into that. And they are, for some reason, showing Pan. The Warner Brothers film Pan got a release date in China for October 22nd, to which I can only say, what Warner Brothers is probably like, can we put something else in that slot? I mean, why? Why?
Well, I'm sure that there was... You know, I would love to be in... on the private phone calls and meetings that take place and all of the inner dealings at these studios when they find out about whether they got a slot or not, and all the inner workings with the MPAA and Chris Dodd kind of negotiating with the China Film Group trying to push certain films.
I just picture Chinese bureaucrats laughing, saying, well, we got to give Warner Brothers something. Well, we're screwing over Disney. What are we going to do for Warner Brothers? We can't screw them all over. And they're like, I know, let them put Pan out. And they all laugh.
But do they laugh like that?
They might laugh more maniacally, but I didn't want to be too xenophobic.
Well, I know one thing they're doing over in China, and that is they're continuing to crack down on box office fraud. We mentioned this a while ago, like I think on the last episode, but now they say, no, we're serious about it. We're going to crack down even further.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, that's, you know, it stays in the news and that they keep paying attention to it. That's a good sign, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem came, and this was pointed out by Patrick Von Sikowski on Celluloid Junkie, shameless plug, but he was talking about, you know, empty theaters that when you went back and you looked at the ticket count, it looked as if it was sold out. And this was
an
empty theater showing a Chinese film. So the question then became, are they kind of goosing the homegrown content?
Well, we know they are.
Yeah, well, now
That's the scandal. Yeah. Yeah, we've got other examples of that. But yes, them. What did he say about them cracking down? Did he feel like this was a yes? They keep talking about it, keep making references to it. Is it just showboating or is it a sign that they're actually going to be doing something?
Nobody can tell. It's like, you know, we'll have to wait and see.
We'll have to wait and see how Spectre does when it opens up in China. Sony, of course, is the studio distributing that around the world. And, you know, first we heard the Daniel Craig saying, I don't know, I may not want to make any more. He's contracted for one more Bond film, but maybe he's trying to bow out early or he just wants to up his fee. I don't know. But now Sony is also saying, hey, they may lose out on the Bond franchise. Would they care if they lost it? That's what I want to know.
Well, again, it depends. It depends on the deal they negotiate, because the budget for this film, $250 million, that is an astounding number. I mean, for that movie, I mean, it's not like you haven't made these movies before, whereas like with Titanic, it's like, oh, there's water, there's all these effects that we've never done. You've made Bond films before, okay? So you know how to do it. The fact that it costs $250 million, that's just... I mean, it's a staggering budget, right?
Daniel Craig's actual money he's going to get, the director, all, you know, it's as expensive as it gets. And they got to top themselves over last time. They made $1 billion. They don't want to mess up again. But the fact is, if everything goes perfectly and the movie grosses $1.1 billion, what we get the sense is that what Sony's participation is with the movie, they get a low distribution fee and they cap their investment in the film.
They'll get about $30 million.
Yeah. If everything goes perfectly, they'll make $30 million.
35 maybe. I don't know.
Right. But now that's misleading, right? Because that also means Sony gets to keep a lot of people working and get their salaries paid. The profits maybe, but it is a big movie that they get to put out and feeds the pipeline and it keeps theaters busy and keeps distributors happy and keeps employees working. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not a joke to say while those, you know, net profits matter, there's a lot going on there beyond that, isn't there?
Well, there is, because of course you mentioned distributors. You know, Sony has distribution deals in other countries that it distributes content and movies through other distributors, some of which they own outright, some of which they're partners in. It makes exhibitors happy, and those are the movie theater owners. But it also, kind of an unwritten, unspoken fact, is that if you know you got Spectre coming up and you've got another film, like, I don't know, they didn't do Steve Jobs, but some other film, you know, you get to...
Like, yeah, you want to release our movie, don't you? Yeah, we do.
Yeah. Notice how nobody ever said, you want to release our movie, right? Because if you don't, we're not going to give you Spectre. You can't say that. That's against the law in the United States.
It's naughty.
Yes. However...
So like...
There's nudge, wink, wink.
They have The Fifth Wave early next year. They have The Night Before, their comedy with Seth Rogen and Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who had a flop with, you know, The Walk, and Anthony Mackie. Maybe, you know, people are going to be kind to that movie, knowing that they've got Spectre coming out first.
Yeah, who knows?
Right. And of course, if they lose James Bond and they lose Daniel Craig, maybe they'll come back with another studio. Maybe James Bond will be a woman, played by a woman, right? It could happen.
Yeah. Now, I know you want to get into this study that was done by the Center for the Center for Study of Women in Television and Film. That is a mouthful.
They did a study of women in television and film.
That's
proving
right.
Proving that they're following their name.
And before we get into that, just one last thing on the Spectre thing. You might be saying, I thought MGM distributed those movies. They do. They are the producer of record, so to speak. However, to distribute those films, it used to be MGM United Artists, but now they've kind of gone out and started to, you know, distribute movies through other studios. So The Hobbit, for instance, an MGM film distributed through Warner Brothers. In this case, Spectre and James Bond, the last four films, and this is the last film in that deal, is being distributed through Sony. Paramount has stepped up and said, hey, maybe you bring it over to us. We'll see what winds up happening.
Yeah. All right. So now we're moving on to women in Hollywood. They don't have a big role and it should be bigger. We got a study. They looked at movies that came out in 2014. They did two levels of their study, one covering the top 250 movies, the big blockbusters, and another one looking at basically any film that got a theatrical release, about the top 700 films. And that's top 700 based on gross. So basically anything that got a pulse, they covered in this study. Sperling, ignore the bloody numbers. Do not start. 80% had no female writers. 30% had no. Forget it. It's very simple. Very few movies have female directors and female writers and female produce, you know. And when you look at indie films and expand the category a bit, go from big Hollywood movies to indie films as well, it gets a little better, but not that much. And when you move beyond director and star and writer, then you find in the craft areas, women are almost non-existent. You know, women accounted for 9% of cinematographers on the top 700 films and 5%, to use just one number, just so we don't go crazy, because I know you love numbers, just one out of 20 cinematographers was a woman on the top 250 movies. So obviously, they want women to be more present in Hollywood. That's why they're focusing on it. And there's a long, long way to go. Even though women buy most tickets, and we've got a list as long as your arm of women who can be box office draws and make, you know, female-centric movies are big hits. And where does the big problem begin? I suppose the number of women who are in executive seats in Hollywood, right?
Well, wait, so you're saying that that's a problem?
More women in power, because more women in power means they will be likely, unless they feel obliged to be more man than the men, to help give more women opportunities at every level of Hollywood. You need more women in power at the Cinematographers Guild, more women in power at the Set Designers Guild, more women in power in the Editors Guild. And you know what? In the early days of Hollywood, women dominated as writers and editors. They were all over the place in Hollywood.
Look at Thelma Schoonmaker, you know, Marty.
Well, no. I'm saying the 1900s, the 10s, the zeros.
Oh,
I'm not
wow. You're going, you're going way back.
I'm not talking about the bloody 70s, for God's sake. I'm saying in the early days of Hollywood, which existed before Thelma Schoonmaker was born, women were dominant in Hollywood. But of course, that's when it was, you know, a disreputable business, out on the fringes, but once it started to make big money, the men stepped in.
I think they were in from the very beginning,
but they pushed women out of, women dominated writing. They were almost, I believe there were a majority of editors were women at one point. Certainly they were very, very dominant, a huge position in Hollywood. They were very important. They were valued. They were part of the business, but then it became too valuable and important and they got shouldered aside. So it's just yet another continuing of the conversation that maybe Jennifer Lawrence helped, you know, bring up again by talking about the pay gap for male and female actors.
Yeah. I would say that this is going to be just like income disparity. It's now an issue
issue and it will never be dealt with.
Well, I think, has income disparity been dealt with over the years? No. So
depends who we elect.
No, that's true. Oh, let's not go there. Let's not go there because we're not a political show and, you know, it's become a circus, literally a circus here in the United States.
That's right. So, you know, it's a study. It brought attention. It got a story or two. Will anything change? Probably not. Which makes the study, does that make the study a big deal or a big whoop?
Oh, I don't know. I'm not going to weigh in on that. But I do know it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, Amazon is cracking down on fake critics, which I like to consider myself a fake critic. It's suing people who advertise on the website Fiverr, offering to give your book or your movie or whatever.
Maybe we should pay him to review our podcast.
Yeah. That's a darn good idea, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, people, come on, review our show. Don't make us pay $5 to strangers.
That's right. You know, so if you give them a 5-star review on Amazon in exchange for cash, they're kind of raking them over the barrel. So Amazon is making clear it is not suing Fiverr itself, but the people who offer to do fake reviews in exchange for money. The fake reviews are against Amazon's terms of service, and of course, they also suggest said reviews are unfair and deceptive. Amazon also recently filed a similar complaint against a website cleverly called buyamazonreviews.com. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. I mean, it's just the next step in what they've been doing for a while and should keep doing for the integrity of their site. They want to prevent fake reviews from being on there. It's not easy to do, not easy to prevent. Sometimes they go too far in the other direction. There's lots of examples in the literary world of people who like start to follow an author on Twitter and Amazon says you're a friend of the author. And they're like, I don't know him. I reviewed his book and I follow him on Twitter. You know, they become friends because they're reviewers or whatever, but you know. So better to err on the side of caution, I suppose. And in this case, of course, they're just going about, you know, downright fraud. So good for them.
Now, Michael, let me ask you, are you ready to return to Stars Hollow?
God, yes.
Well, yes, it looks like one of Michael's favorite TV shows, Gilmore Girls, is set to be revived. I thought this announcement would break the internet, I swear. The creator was...
Hey.
Well, I'm just saying, there's so many people talking about it. You might recall, Michael, the creator was forced out and thus didn't get to end the series on her own terms. Now, Amy Sherman-Palladino is in talks with Netflix to bring back the series, which has done well for the streaming service in reruns. Stars Lauren Graham and Alexis Bledel are interested, though not apparently Melissa McCarthy. The plan is perhaps for 4 TV movies each 90 minutes long. This comes on top of Netflix reviving both Full House and Arrested Development. Big deal or big whoop.
And Longmire, I think that's Netflix too, isn't it?
I think so, yes.
Yeah, so it's a big deal for me. I love Gilmore Girls. I don't really want them to bring back the show because, you know, it was a good show and the last 2 years weren't great, especially when Amy Sherman-Palladino wasn't involved anymore. But hey, it'll be fun to see them get back together. Melissa McCarthy, don't be a jerk. Come on, go on the show. She apparently hated her role. I don't understand. It's the best role she's ever had. But we know that she has the ending of the show in her head. It's 4 words. She's known what they were going to be all along, and I know what they are too. I'm predicting it's Lauren Graham turning to Alexis Bledel because Alexis just says, I'm pregnant. And Lauren Graham says, you are? Me too. Because I think the mother and daughter will both be pregnant at the same time at the end of the series. That's been my prediction all along.
You know what? I can say this. You really want to revive something, Netflix? Go revive Smash.
Oh, God. It's coming to Broadway at the musical. That should be enough for you. Leave it alone.
All right, fine. Now, we've talked about how video games are becoming very popular, at least as events for audiences to watch. Some top-line players can make millions of dollars a year in prize money and endorsements through these competitions. It's a big business, and where money goes, corruption often follows. South Korea is at the center of another scandal surrounding the game StarCraft II. That competition arena was plagued by a scandal 5 years ago, and now it's happened again. A coach and a top player have been arrested, and allegations of payoffs, thrown games, and more are proliferating. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. I mean, when you want it to grow into a worldwide franchise, and it happens here in the U.S. too, you want to have integrity, and you got to fight some stuff like this. So it's a big deal that they're cracking down. You know where there's money, there's going to be corruption. They got to fight it, and they haven't solved the problem yet.
Are there any fantasy video game leagues? Because that would be incredibly ironic.
I don't know if it would be ironic, but I don't think there are, because I don't think there's enough of a track record and things like that, and they're not diverse enough and big enough to do that yet, but I'm sure it will
basically
come.
A game about play. Yeah, okay. Well, Michael, do you want to go to a concert tonight after the show?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I can't decide whether we should check out like Frank Sinatra circa the Capitol years, maybe Lenny Bruce in full uncensored mode, Elvis in the 1970s, you know, fat Elvis, or maybe even Judy Garland doing her Carnegie Hall show. Now, you might be asking, Michael, I know I can almost read your mind. You're thinking, is any of this even possible? And I will have to admit, not quite yet. But soon, because of holograms, and holograms are expected to become a significant part of the entertainment industry, Andy Kaufman and Red Fox may be dead, but they'll both be touring in hologram form soon. And this is a quote. There are an awful lot of dead celebrities, Alfie David of Hologram USA said in the New York Times. There are an awful lot of dead people with a lot of followers. The fresher the memory, the bigger the star.
Jesus, the tour.
Yeah, I can't, but like, as I read that quote, I just thought, are you serious? Well, for Kaufman and Fox, you can expect everything from backstory like Fox hanging out with Malcolm X to Kaufman doing his Mighty Mouse bit. Big deal or big whoop?
At the moment, it's a big whoop, but I mean, eventually they will do it artistically and well, and it will become a big deal because they'll
do it
right.
Yeah, we talked about this in the past with Whitney Houston.
But it's getting bigger. I mean, this is like, you know, there are one-offs, and, you know, they'll have Billie Holiday at the Apollo Theater doing a little thing. But this is like they're going to tour and take it around the country. I mean, it's getting more and more complicated. They did it with Sinatra. They're doing it here. It's starting to become more of a regular thing, and it's weird, but eventually they'll do it well, and it'll become sort of artistic, and, you know, it'll work.
Well, Yahoo had a big hit with live streaming NFL. You might, you know, a couple weeks ago, they had 15 million people tune in to a live stream of an NFL game taking place in the United Kingdom. The problem with that, of course, is that they can't sell the ads for as much money as they can when it's on television, when it's broadcast.
You mean like on CBS or something?
Right, exactly. So the NFL is kind of looking and going, yeah, well, thanks, Yahoo, but actually this TV stuff, it's still quite lucrative.
Well, I think they were very happy with the experiment, though.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yes.
Right, because they'd love to have Netflix bidding with the major networks for football.
One more bidder. Come all ye faith. Yeah. But, you know, for Yahoo, not all original programming is working. And it's not a good member of the community, in fact, at least not the community of fans of the cult sitcom Community. I didn't say community enough in that last sentence. During a conference call about a poor quarter, Yahoo singled out Community as a financial failure. They simply couldn't make doing original programming at this level pay off for the site. So while a season 7 is out of the question, insiders say a movie could still happen, just not at Yahoo, of course. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal because if you want to do original programming, you don't diss the shows that you made. You know, why this show was a huge flop for us, financial disaster. It's okay to explain things, but like you would think they'd do a better job of saying, we love the show, we were happy about it, blah, blah, blah. The numbers didn't work out, or whatever. But like, it's like they were blaming their original programming for their loss rather than just saying, well, you know, the numbers haven't worked yet. But like, who else wants to bring a show to Yahoo now? You know, they make it sound like they're the enemy of their original programming. So I don't think they handled it very well.
Well, maybe they can bring it to Vice. Vice is finally getting its own TV channel. The branded entertainment news site is partnering with A&E and taking over their History Channel spinoff. Vice might have taken over Time Warner's headline news, but talks broke down when Vice insisted on editorial control. Imagine that. They want editorial control. They got that with A&E and will launch in 70 million homes in 2016 with heavy expansion plans in Europe scheduled as well. Meanwhile, ESPN... they're scaling down. The sports empire is laying off 300 employees, some 4% of its 8,000-member workforce. They've also pulled the plug on the acclaimed website Grantland. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal for ESPN scaling down, but they're a mature business. You know, they've got multiple channels, tons of programming. They make a lot of money, so it's not the end of the world for them. Vice, of course, is growing. And it's a big deal that they're getting their own channel. But guess what? It's a lot easier to get YouTube hits than it is to get eyeballs watching your cable channel. It may be a bit of a slap in the face for them when this launches. We'll have to see.
Well, you know, ESPN is just suffering from the fact that due to cable cutting and the shift as to where consumers get their news, that or not their news, but their content, those guaranteed cable retransmission fees, they aren't so guaranteed anymore, and they're actually bracing for that.
But they're insisting that we are not going to go over the top yet, that they're still committed to cable.
Well, and another kind of, to underscore, I should say, how people are kind of changing and shifting their viewing habits, YouTube launched its ad-free option called YouTube Red. They have a handful of originals, but mostly the appeal is watching YouTube without having to sit through any ads. It costs $10 a month, to which Netflix said, see... our $10 a month is pretty good, right? Big deal or big whoop?
Why does Netflix sound like a 12-year-old boy?
Because
I was not just one at that.
Yeah, I don't know.
I think it's a big deal because, boy, it sounds expensive, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. I mean,
YouTube's like, wait, we got hundreds of millions of hours. But we're like, yeah, whatever. $10 just so I can skip a 5-second ad in front of a music video? you know, it just seems awfully expensive for what they offer.
Well, and this could have been a whole, we could have done a whole segment on this because of the way YouTube went about forcing producers into this Red program. It was very similar to how they forced musicians and musical artists into their music service.
Well, that's where people go to play videos, though, isn't it?
Yes, but
it's a huge business, but, you know, they don't create that content. You know, they do pay for programming. They are doing some of that. But most of the stuff you go to watch on YouTube is not YouTube generated.
No. And when you're asking somebody to pay $10 a month and you're producing House of Cards with Kevin Spacey, that's one thing. When you are basically saying, we will annoy you unless you pay us $10 a month to watch this amateur play with his cat on a piano, then you know what? Yeah, I'll pass.
And that's, you know, it's partially unfair. They do have YouTube stars.
Yes.
And some people that they have supported and some original program that has clicked for them. But the simple fact is, like you say, it feels like they're demanding money just so you don't keep annoying them. That's a great way to put it.
Yeah, I made that up literally on the spot.
That's the magic of podcasting.
Yes. Now, you know, while we're on the subject here, HBO is furious with Comcast and other providers who it says are dragging their feet and refuse to bundle HBO Now with their broadband service. You might recall HBO Now being their kind of standalone, over-the-top offering. Why won't you help us destroy the pay cable TV package that is the heart of your entire business? Asked HBO. CEO Richard Plepler says he just doesn't understand it. He doesn't understand why. HBO Now is available via Apple and Roku, two companies that have nothing to do with the cable TV industry. Verizon and Cablevision are also on board, but Comcast and the potentially merging Time Warner Cable and Charter, well, they continue to give it the fisheye. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, right? Everything's changing. They're afraid to do it right now. They'll probably do it in the future.
Okay. You know,
eventually, if it's too popular and people want it, they don't want to lose customers just because they won't allow HBO Now to be sold on their thing. Eventually, they'll have to cave.
Well, while we're asking people to pay for content, okay, why don't we ask Pandora what they're doing? Pandora is ponying up. Apparently, just because an album was recorded before 1972 doesn't mean it's fair game under copyright. The record labels have won in court. First, Spotify settled claims by paying $210 million to record labels. Now, Pandora is doing the same with a settlement to labels amounting to $90 million. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. We knew it was going to happen, but they're all forking over money, and we just need to, like, rehaul copyright completely, don't we?
Yeah, I mean, this was done because there was a loophole in the copyright law that was passed February 15th, 1972, allowing folks like Pandora and SiriusXM to say, well, no, those are in the public domain. Anything recorded before that date is in the public domain, and we don't have to pay a licensing fee for that, or we don't have to license and pay for those. Well, I guess SiriusXM was taken to court. They lost a couple rounds, and they said, you know what, we're not going to fight this anymore. We'll just pay. So now everybody's paying up. Well, I'm jumping all over the place in our notes here, Michael. I have to admit, I'm you know what, let's skip.
You're leaving me a little dizzy.
I know. Let's skip Chris Rock and Ricky Gervais.
Don't tell them what you're skipping.
Okay, well, you know, come on. It's not even that important. Chris Rock's going to host the Oscars. Ricky Gervais is back as the, they're both going to host stuff. Okay, I know you hate it when I do that.
Well, everybody knows. They've heard it. Unless you have something original to add, why do it?
No, although Chris Rock was
Oh, my God, stop.
Wait, Chris Rock was at the performance of Hamilton that I saw. That's about all I've got to say about that. I'm trying to find this story we had on Supergirl. Ah, here it is. Supergirl had a big debut week on CBS, matching NBC's Blind Spot in the ratings, adding up to some 16 million viewers in live plus three numbers.
That makes those the two biggest, you know, premieres for the new season for new shows.
Right. Now, its second episode naturally dropped some 30% in the show's regular Monday night time slot. The hit drama Scorpion actually improved on its Supergirl lead-in.
And is a better show.
Whoa. We'll have to see where it lands in the ratings after another few weeks before knowing how the show is really doing. CBS certainly got it sampled, which is not a given since Supergirl is not an obvious fit for the network, since, you know, they kind of skew older over there at CBS. But the real action is taking place online. CBS announced its plans to go over the top with the next Star Trek TV series. And no, I did not stutter. Star Trek TV series, another Star Trek TV series. They're going to launch a new TV show, but say it will be available exclusively on CBS All Access. It's OTT service. No word yet on the setting of the show. I'm going to go with space. Its timeline. I'm going to go with in the future. Characters. I'm going to go with a few that we know.
But is it in the future of the series, or is it like a prequel where you're at the academy with young James Kirk, or is it, you know?
I'm going to go with the womb. Okay. It's James Kirk in the womb.
What's the plan?
They don't even know how many episodes. But the plan is to debut the pilot on the network and then send everyone to CBS All Access to see later episodes. Ooh, that's basically a big, you know, flipping the bird to traditional.
No, you're trying to let people see as much of it as possible. Let the world see it. It's not obnoxious. It's smart.
Okay, well, all right, fine. They're using one platform to promote another. So speaking of which, on The Librarians, which I believe is a TBS show, they advertised Supergirl, and my kids were like, "Ooh, we want to see that. That looks cool." I predict that Supergirl will actually kind of grow a little bit in the ratings because it's getting good buzz, good word of mouth, and I think people are going to start sampling it later in the series.
Good buzz. You've seen two episodes.
I haven't seen any. I'm just hearing. You know,
where's
I'm going
the good buzz?
You know, just word of mouth kind of, you know, this is all anecdotal.
All right. Yeah, it's bad.
It's bad? Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's not good. You know, but that doesn't mean it won't be a hit. But anyway, is this a big deal? Big whoop. Star Trek is what I'm excited about. At first, I thought, oh, my God, why are you doing this with such a valuable franchise? Why are you hiding it in OTT to try and power some new platform when it's such a valuable show you'd want to put on your network and get big, big ratings? But in fact, that's what they did with Star Trek The Next Generation, right? That was a first-run syndicated series. That was pretty path-breaking. Not that that hadn't been done before, but that's one of the biggest properties ever to go to first-run syndication right off the bat. And it worked really, really well. And, you know, now they're going to pioneer in a new area with Star Trek. So be interesting to see what happens.
I just know CBS wanted to say, we're down with OTT.
That's right.
I couldn't wait to get that joke out.
Ah, neither could we.
Yeah. Well, I guess that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, this week, I'm going to read the definition of Gamergate, okay? This is from the Los Angeles Times.
Okay.
Describing Gamergate to those outside the gaming community is a difficult task. But framing Gamergate as a debate is too kind. From the moment the term emerged as a hashtag in mid-August of 2014, it was ugly, messy, and convoluted. Female game designers and critics who spoke out about the medium's future experienced harassment, including threats of rape and death, and saw details about their personal lives published online, a practice referred to as doxing. Now, part of doxing is saying, oh, Michael Giltz lives at the following address, and here's his phone number. That's considered doxing. If I put that online on, say, Reddit, which is what happened here, that would be doxing.
Right. You're taking publicly available information, perhaps, but publicizing it as much as possible to make people feel vulnerable and threatened.
Correct.
Anyway, so Gamergate began as a sort of an issue where people were saying there's corruption in the journalism world covering video games, and we want to expose this corruption, but it quickly morphed into just ugly attacks on women who dare speak out about the culture of video games and the online community.
Correct.
And so you have people who are smart and intelligent and great that most people think are great, like Felicia Day, right?
Correct, yes.
She's been harassed. It's unbelievable. And I'm waiting. Why aren't people arrested? Is it that hard to track them down? People are getting death threats. People had like a lecture on a college campus that they had to shut down because people were threatening like the worst shooting. You know, it's like it's really easy to like put the fear into people. You know, you say, oh, well, I'm going to do a school shooting. If you have a lecture, people get scared. Right. They're like, oh, my God, do we want to risk that just to make a point about, you know, freedom of speech? Sometimes they say no. Sometimes they make that mistake. You know, but it's not an easy judgment call, is it? You don't know what to take seriously or not. But there has been very real harassment and obnoxious online stalking of women and other people who talk about the issue of sexism and fairness and progressivism in the online world.
Yeah. And this was one of those things that, you know, you almost hate to bring it up. And that's
no,
the
I don't.
Whole.
Why?
That, well,
there are jerks and idiots online who need to be arrested for threatening people physically, you know, threatening to kill them, threatening violence, who are, you know, harassing people. They should be arrested and put in jail. I'd be happy to talk about that any day of the week. But South by Southwest decided to talk about it, and then it hit the fan.
Yes, and by it, we mean, well, let's just put it this way. There are two letters that you would put in front of the word it. One is an it. H,
keep
one
going.
Is an
yes, okay. Yes.
Well, they had two different panels scheduled for next year's South by Southwest.
And when is next year's South by Southwest?
It's usually in March in 2016.
It's in Austin.
In Austin, Texas. They have a film festival, a music festival, and an interactive festival for web and video games and all things tech. One of the panels was Level Up, Overcoming Harassment in Games, and another panel was Save Point, a discussion on the gaming community. Now, the Gamer Gators, these are the people who kind of, they take it upon themselves to make these threats to kind of behave improperly or what would be deemed as improperly to most
what?
People.
Why are you pussyfooting around?
Well,
these
because
bastards are, you know, physically are threatening violence and attacks against other people who talk on this issue.
Well, part of the issue is that, you know, they are free to make their own comments and voice their own thoughts. They shouldn't be.
They're not.
You're
not allowed
violence.
To threaten to kill someone for having a, you're not allowed to threaten to bomb or attack or shoot people.
Correct.
For having a panel discussion on anything. You're not allowed to. There's no debate about this. These are people who are breaking the law, who need to be arrested and sent to jail.
Well, Level Up's panel include Carolyn Sinders from IBM Watson, Catherine Cross from the City University of New York Graduate Center, Randy Harper from the Online Abuse Prevention Initiative, and these women, as you know, I guess BuzzFeed reported that quote had previously been targets of harassment both online and off.
Right.
So you know,
so they did a great job. They set up two important panels to talk about an important issue, and what happened?
Well, all of the Gamer Gators came onto the South by Southwest website and on Reddit, and they started saying, you know, we're going to, you know, basically there will be violence, physical violence at South by Southwest in 2016 if those panels are allowed to be held.
Can we, do we call them Gamer Gators? Can we just call them vigilantes or punks?
Well, they are kind of punks in that regard.
Well, they're not,
yes.
Kind of, they are. Of course, hiding behind anonymous online anonymity, hiding behind repeating words over and over again, you know, using online anonymity to threaten other people and stifle speech is as punky as it gets.
I liked what Vox had to say regarding this issue, and it's, you know, South by Southwest, their response was, okay, we'll just cancel them. We'll just, you know.
Yeah, we don't want this firestorm of nightmareness. Oh, my God.
Yeah,
and so then everybody yelled at them and said, what are you doing? You're caving to the very thing we're trying to talk about.
Right. Talk about, you know, a chilling effect. Congratulations. You've proven that a chilling effect can happen through harassment. Now, Vox wrote, the security needed at a festival like South by Southwest, you know, the size of South by Southwest isn't exactly a minor undertaking. It's not that South by Southwest couldn't provide protection for the Level Up panelists against threats of violence. It's that it didn't seem to want to. And I would agree with that. They kind of came off as like, you know what? This is just too much trouble.
It is too much trouble, though. I'm assuming usually you have a film festival like Cannes or South by Southwest or anything. You don't typically get death threats against people who were appearing there to promote their new video game or their new movie.
No.
So
no.
It's not something they typically had dealt with a lot. And we're used to, and just said, oh, in this case, we don't want to bother. They said, oh, my God, what the hell? We tried to have a panel and people threatened to kill people. Oh, my God. But they panicked and they canceled both. And that was wrong. And everybody yelled at them. And what did they do?
Well, Hugh Forrest, director of South by Southwest Interactive, he said, quote, and this was by Friday of last week. This is what happened. He said, by canceling two sessions, we send an unintended message that South by Southwest not only tolerates online harassment, but condones it. And for that, we are truly sorry. And he went on to say that the resulting feedback from individuals involved and the community at large resonated loud and clear. They're going to reinstate the two panels.
Right. So, you know, obviously, you know what we think about people who harass and threaten to kill other people online for having opinions they disagree with. What do we think about South by Southwest? They made a big mistake. Did they recover? Did they do a good job in recovering? What do you think?
I think time will tell. I don't think they fully recovered, in my opinion. I think this is a community that is very progressive, and you were not very progressive. And I think the interactive portion of this this whole convention has been damaged. Whether it's irreparably damaged, time will tell. But I, you know, ultimately, I think you get enough people in Austin every year that a few years from now, this will all be kind of brushed away.
So you don't think it will have any long-term negative effects for South by Southwest?
No, I mean, you had people like Vox and BuzzFeed and certain media outlets say, you know what, we're going to boycott South by Southwest if they for doing what they did by pulling these panels. Well, it'll be interesting to see if anybody truly boycotts them. I don't think
they didn't need to because they reinstated them.
Yeah.
There's no boycott in place because they reinstated them.
Right.
There's no boycott to be done. They said unless you reinstate them and do right by this, and they believe or they've tried to do right, correct?
Yes,
then
they
did. So nobody's threatened to boycott it still. They're not saying, all right, you reinstate the panels, but I still refuse to cover it. That would be a little pointless.
Yes, well...
Yes, of course, that would be stupid.
Well, and while some people, they hate the whole Gamergate movement and the people who...
What do you mean? Who doesn't hate people threatening to kill women for talking about, you know, sexism or whatever in the online world? Is there somebody who doesn't hate those people?
Well, the online, remember Breitbart? Remember that online outlet? It's still around.
Nope. I don't know what it is.
You have no idea what Breitbart is.
Not really.
Okay. It's a kind of a right-wing, very conservative media outlet here in the United States.
Like the Drudge Report?
But even more right-wing.
Just really posted stuff, whatever. Yeah. I wasn't thinking politics. So now Breitbart sounds a little familiar. Yeah.
Yes.
And they hired one of the visible symbols of these, you know, Gamergate people to work for them, right?
Yes, because he became this celebrity of social media and Gamergate. And he was kind of as the LA Times called him, a glorified internet troll.
It's Milo Yiannopoulos. Yiannopoulos?
Yes. I don't know how to pronounce his last name.
Yiannopoulos.
Milo. Let's just call him Milo. He is kind of going out there and saying this is a free speech issue. It has nothing to do with feminism and you know. But ultimately, he kind of he has been described gaming as coming under siege by, quote, an army of sociopathic feminist programmers and campaigners. So we'll let you,
as opposed to the people who are threatening to kill them for talking.
So we'll let you be the judge of Mr. Milo over here and whether, you know, he's kind of a free speech advocate. Ultimately,
there's nothing left to say.
Yeah,
they're assholes and we don't like them and they're hateful. And why isn't law enforcement must have been called in.
Oh,
people
absolutely.
Should be arrested. Is it that hard to track them down? You know, come on.
Well, you know, I guess you really hit the nail on that. There's little left to say. That's why I'm so silent about it, because I have nothing to say. I mean, it's like, you read about it and you just go, really? Wow. Okay.
Well, but thank goodness when we read about it initially with South by Southwest canceling them, and you thought, well, that's a mistake. And it was a mistake and they corrected themselves. Thank goodness.
That's true.
So problem averted. Now we get to wait for March to see how the panels actually go.
Yes. But
and then there will be no more sexism in the video game industry.
I highly doubt that. But somebody who will not be in attendance at South by Southwest is Maureen O'Hara, who died at the age of 95 this past weekend.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people die, of course, all the time. People that you recognize and love, they're on TV shows, they're talented people. We're mentioning Maureen O'Hara because she was so symbolic in a way. She was called the Queen of Technicolor.
Because of her red hair, her bright red hair.
Her red hair and her cream complexion skin. She was like a walking billboard for Technicolor. That's how they saw her even. And she had a great career. I mean, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, How Green Was My Valley, Miracle on 34th Street, and The Quiet Man. She worked with Hitchcock, Renoir, John Ford, you know, had a great career, played a lot of strong-willed women, and was the queen of Technicolor. Technicolor still used, right?
Well, Technicolor is a company now, and was then too, which is where Technicolor got its name. It's not, it was a photographic process, not in use anymore.
Ah, so the day has passed for Technicolor as it has passed for Maureen O'Hara.
Yes, unfortunately. And, you know, I had met Maureen O'Hara once or twice at, you know, screenings of films that were like commemorative screenings here
in Los Angeles.
She was always very nice and loved her accent. She was Irish, obviously.
Ah, she was a bonny lass.
Yes. And we don't have accents unless you're from another country. So technically, to most of the world, we have funny accents, Michael. Did you realize that?
Why are we filling?
We're not. We're actually just trying to let people know. From all over the world who listen to us, actually, that, hey, if...
God forbid we almost got in under an hour.
Oh, my
yes,
God.
Please call us, email us, write to us. How do they do it?
Dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's D-I-R-T at showbizsandbox.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail at 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263.
Very good.
that was my, you know, those people.
Now, we got it. We got okay. it. You don't need to repeat. Tell us what the joke was. We understood.
Okay, fine. Well, then, you know what? On a serious note, you can subscribe to the show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can rate and review the show in those aggregators. It does help us out when you do that, and we are trying to find more places to do so.
And it's cheaper than paying someone $5 to give us 5 stars, even though they've never listened to the show. So please, for God's sakes, you know you've never done it. Go on iTunes right now. Just click in 5 stars. God forbid you write a line, too. But, you know, at least click in some stars.
Yes. Definitely talk about how funny that Sperling character is.
Yeah. Funny as in haha or funny. Anyway.
So we got ways to subscribe to the show, ways to contact us. All of that information, as well as links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find ways to follow us on Twitter. @showbizsandbox is our handle on Twitter. And you can like us on Facebook. If you search for Showbiz Sandbox, our page should come up. Again, all of this information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their own website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Gilt has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
It's gamergatorsord.com. It'll probably crash within an hour.
Well, if you can't find any of Michael's work on that particular website, why don't you search for, MichaelGiltz.com or The Huffington Post, or you can head on over to BookFilter and read some of Michael's work there. Some of my work can be found on CelluloidJunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.